Welcome, movie lovers, back for another Anatomy of Movie here at Popcorn Talk. We've seen a lot of billboards for a lot of things, but never in my life have I seen these types of billboards, particularly these three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri. So stay tuned as we dissect.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Feel that music. Enjoy this podcast. As we build up, I like this song. We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans. How's it going?
It's going good. And I'm Phil Svitek, and we're talking, of course, three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri. If you're joining us for the very first time, welcome. You've come to the right place. If you're rejoining us, you've come to the right place, too. And so thank you. We do appreciate you guys. As we talk about these various things, we get the conversation going on the various movies we talk about, but by no means is a definitive one and done. By all means, comment, let us know, and also let your cinephile friends know that we're out here, if you have any. Or make a friend, you know? What a great excuse to make a friend. Hey, did you hear about Anatomy of a Movie? No, I did not. Tell me more. It's friendship.
There you go.
There you go.
And then you have three new friends from this panel.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right here.
And of course, if you're joining us for the first time, one of the things to note is that we are spoiler-filled. One, number two, you can get our rundown in the description box so that way you can follow along with all of our research. There's the administrative stuff out of the way. Now the fun stuff. Our overall thoughts on the movie. Marissa, kick us off.
First of all, I love Frances McDormand. She is genius. So I was really excited to see this film. I heard really good things about it. I saw this because this movie was released limited in Los Angeles and, you know, the metropolitan areas. So I fortunately saw this early in December. I really liked it because from the people who have been able to see the movies early, they told me it was good. I went in, and yeah, it was good. I think the acting was great. I think the writing is good. There is an element of the story. Bless you. There's an element of the story that I have to question, especially when we get to it. I'll bring it up. But I think overall, the characters were very interesting to follow. There was good pacing. Just good writing and acting and story meshed together in this film.
Right on. Dimitri?
Yeah, it's an odd duck movie for me because on the one hand it is well written, but you'd have to argue that it is very Coen-esque, Coen Brothers-esque in its delivery, in the way that it feels and looks, this dark, seedy side going on. Of course, having Frances McDormand in it as well, a Coen Brothers favorite, lends a little bit to that feel to it. And it's sort of billed as almost a mystery who killed the daughter, and yet by end of the movie, the mystery is the biggest red herring of this movie. It's really not about the mystery at all. It really is a character study of these three distinct characters. Played by Woody Harrelson, Frances McDormand. Woody Harrelson as Sheriff Willoughby, and then Sam Rockwell as Dixon. And in that part, I found it to be very interesting to watch. I felt it's a very good movie. From my own personal taste, I found this to be a very difficult movie to watch. For me, it was a hard movie to get through. Not because it was bad. It's not like it was Phantom Thread. It was a difficult movie to get through for other reasons, but for me, it's a movie that's about loss. It's a movie about rage due to loss and where to place it when you have no place to put that rage and how one copes with it. And it's, you know, and then there was a character who's dying of cancer. So there are right there, you've got three things that I've had to deal with personally. And I understood at least the Frances McDormand character, albeit her daughter died very differently, but violent and crazy nonetheless. But dealing with that loss, I mean, there was something there for me that I was like, it was hard to watch, even as good as her performance is. And, you know, watching Dixon, too, he's not the most likable character. And we'll get into Sam Rockwell's performance because he's still almost Archie Bunker-esque in that, yeah, he's a dope and a jerk and a bigot, but there's still something in there that you can find that you like about him. I also, you know, I watched the movie and I didn't know that Ebbing was a fictional town. They did such a great job of setting up this yeah. Nebraska.
It takes place in North Carolina.
Right. So I actually felt that.
No, but they shot in North Carolina. That's
but
my
the
joke.
Deal is, and we'll talk Nebraska. About these plot points. I felt that was like, this was an alternate universe kind of a movie because I don't know in what universe a cop can throw somebody out a window, punch a woman in the face, and they just not get fired right on the spot. And, like, nobody says boo. You know, and where suicide doesn't negate a life insurance policy. You know, there were certain things like that that I found. But, again, when you're looking at nuance of character and performance, this movie has it all. I'm not going to say that many people find it entertaining. And I get it because it's different. It's different. It's a different movie than anything that's out there right now. But I think, you know, I was bringing my own baggage into this movie. And you can criticize me for that if you'd like. But I do think that with every movie that we go to as individuals, there is a certain amount of baggage that everybody brings to a movie, regardless of what the movie is, whether it's a comedy or whatever. So because of that, it made it a hard movie for me to watch. And I think that was punctuated by Frances McDormand's performance. Mm-hmm. I got it. She was fantastic in this movie.
I appreciate this movie enough. There was, as you mentioned, there's enough there that's widely different that I'd never seen in a multitude of arenas, really. Even starting with the character perspective, and I know this is kind of jumping ahead, but it's even just the advertisement itself with having the three actors who would become the three central characters. I thought that was quite interesting because they do become the three main characters, and each of them has a unique arc. Maybe you could say Woody Harrelson doesn't quite have quite an arc, but the impact and the goodwill he leaves on the movie I've never seen before, certainly not from a suicide. So I thought that in itself was interesting, and the way, you know, Dixon is a very fascinating character, and he is able to redeem himself in some ways, and then as time goes by. Mildred, to me, becomes more of a heinous character because she's not, you know, the goodwill that both of these people are trying to bring, and in particular Willoughby, she's not receiving. And even, like, from Peter, you know, Peter Dinklage, I appreciate his character because he called her out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what the only conceit of the movie that I had that I wasn't happy with is the ending where everyone's just still miserable. And the only solution to that is, hey, we're going to go kill people.
Yeah, that was my problem. So.
And I get that, but do you not feel that there was any growth in Mildred because of that ending? Because, you know, to me specifically in that scene, yes, they're going to go out on this mission of revenge. And along the drive, it's like, do you still want to do this? Who knows? Yeah. And well, you know what? Let's just keep driving. We'll figure it out. I guess the question that to throw on the table is: do you think they went through with what they originally set out to do,
Marissa?
No, and I think that the movie definitely leaves an ambiguous ending. I don't think I would like to think that they didn't, but because people make brash decisions when they're irrational or like when they get emotional, and I think. What more so bothered me with the story element and just the character development, so Mildred spends this whole movie trying to just, like, seek the murderer of her daughter and get justice for this unfortunate death and inhumane death, but then to reciprocate with the same type of revenge towards this person. Like, what message are you sending if you're only going to fight fire with fire? Two wrongs don't make a right. And it just shows, like, I had a hard time with Mildred. I was like, you're trying to seek justice for a murder, and yet you want to murder someone else. Like, it just didn't make her character as likable as she could have been at the end. Because when you finally get that false sense of hope that, hey, they might have caught the guy, but just to equal it out with the same acts of something that killed and caused so much pain in your life, just to equal it with that, it's not a good quality for a character, and it makes the story at the end, like, not satisfactory.
Well, number one, for me, I 100% think they did it. I mean, these are two hotheads. You just mentioned that he threw some guy out the window. She threw
Molotov cocktails
at the police station.
True.
These are people that, you know, I'm pretty sure they can go through with it. There's not, but the second part of it, the reason why I feel let down by the ending is because Willoughby wrote one of the most amazing letters, and to each of them, right? And it was so heartfelt, and Dixon's came last, and I think it was a great letter to sort of end on with last, because he said, you know, try a little love, essentially, and you might be surprised with what you get. Did love fail? Is it okay? Try a little love. If that doesn't work, go kill people.
See,
well, like, I think love is the wrong term for this situation. I think just try a little compassion.
And the way I took that is I think it did touch Dixon. I think each of the letters touched. I believe it touched Mildred. And how many movies do we have where a lead character is named Mildred? So, I think it touched Mildred, and I think it touched Dixon. And I think that's why it inspired Dixon to be a better investigator, put aside this, right? Because even the new sheriff in town, who fires him, not for throwing a guy out a window, mind you, just for mouthing off, he gets fired, right? But when he overhears the whole thing where Dixon gets evidence, potential evidence, you know, even that the new sheriff in town says, that was good work, Dixon, right? So you get a sense that he can do this job. And you get a sense that even though Mildred and Dixon were at odds with one another, Dixon, through his love, or maybe his compassion, as you said, which is a good word too, and applicable, I think that he said, hey, you know, this guy has done some bad things. You know, he should receive some justice. I'm not saying it's the right thing, but I think he only said that to her because he felt there was some, he felt something. He actually felt something from Mildred, right? Where he was fighting her the entire movie. And personally, I don't think that they ended up going through with their act of revenge murder. I think that they may have taken a road trip. I think there was a definite bonding, particular in the scene when, hey, Dixon, I got to tell you something. I burned down the police station. And the line was like, of course you did. It's like, and right there in that instance, I think things changed. And when the question gets asked, when there was so much resolve to figure out this murder and get justice, but then the question comes up is, you still want to go through with this? I don't know really anymore. It's like, yeah, let's just keep on driving down the road. We'll figure it out. Hey, you got a granola bar or something. To me, that was the sense of the changing of the tide for both of these characters in a sense. Again, it's a hard movie when you're talking about rage. Look, if there's no compartment to put this rage and this unsolved murder, unfortunately, there are victims to that rage. And I'm not condoning it, but I understood where that Mildred was coming from, because no, she felt helpless. There was nothing that anybody can do, and yet she lost her daughter. And I understood where she was coming from. It's not what
they can do, it's that no one was doing anything.
But everybody had done what they could do at that point. She felt there wasn't enough. And when you're building up that so much rage, there's no place to put it. even though people are doing the right thing to an extent.
Let's take a step back, because it's not, you know, the story's layered in such a way that it's not just whether or not she's critical of people doing their jobs or not doing their jobs. We don't know the exact reason how and why it happened. However, the last things that they said to each other was, maybe I'll get raped. Good, I hope you get raped. And so she lives with that guilt that she put that out into the universe. I don't necessarily know her philosophy, but she, you know, in her mind, she stamped that vote of approval and said, hey, this is what's going to happen to you today. Boom, that's it. So I don't think there's anything that people could actually do if they find this kid. She lives with that guilt, knowing that that's the last word she said to her daughter. And that she the only person that can resolve that is her.
Right, and I think that's also where, like, the rage bleeds in with just self-personal atonement for what she said. To wish that upon your own daughter, yeah, that's a horrible thing to do. So, like, and I think that's why she was channeling her anger and energy, because she wants it, yeah, justice for her daughter, but also to, you know, clear her conscience as well.
Yeah, and look, she ain't Mother Teresa.
This not woman, by any means.
Right? I mean, as from what we gather, right? Again, it all just comes back to, what am I going to do? I feel as if, like, okay, she said this harsh thing, but nothing, it's an unsolved thing. I've got all this rage. I got no place to dump it. And I'm trying to do the right thing. And I'm trying to get people to listen, and it feels as if nobody's listening. And I understood where her character was coming from to an extent. I sympathized and empathized with her, but it was just hard to watch when they were burning the billboards down and she's trying to save those billboards. There was one time when she just had this primal scream, and good God, I had to look away because she could do nothing else. Yeah, it was a very nuanced performance by McDormand as well.
I think that was a great performance, that particular scene, because as heartbreaking as it is, and like how desperate she was to save those billboards, because that's literally the only thing she had going on in her life.
Right.
And when that literally burns up in flames and right in front of her, she's left with nothing. Mm-hmm. Right. She basically has no family. I mean, she has a disconnect with her own son and stuff. So, like, these billboards are the only thing that keeps her living and keeps her going in life, and then they're burning up in flames. She has nothing else.
Right. And there is one other example that I'll cite from the movie where I think that there is a marked change within Mildred, and that is the scene that takes place on the date in the restaurant bar, where her ex-husband comes in with the younger girl, and she's there with Peter Dinklage's character. And it's interesting because she picks up her bottle of wine and starts walking towards her ex-husband's table. And you're thinking, oh, shit, she's just going to clock him. But she goes over there, puts it down, and she just tells the husband, like, take care of her. You make sure you take care of her. And she just turns around and walks away. And I'm like, to me, that was a sign of change. And she actually sort of felt something for this girl, regardless that this girl, you know, was very young, not the brightest, but still, she found something in that girl of an innocence that she knows that she had lost, and that perhaps she always believed her daughter had. And I think
she's protective of young women. Because she reminded her of her daughter.
Yep.
Well, it's interesting that she is so insulting initially about her, simply because that's who the other guy is dating. But, you know, the movie makes it very clear. They didn't, that's not a guy you want to date. So the fact that she has any sort of ill content towards her, yeah, I think it should be 100% like, hey, just so you shouldn't date this guy, not, oh, I hate the girl that you're dating. And there's that weird difference, but it is that difference, and so I don't get it.
And she's
not as protective over that girl.
But she can't prevent them necessarily from dating, and I think she realized, like, she has no, into her husband's life. She's got, or her ex-husband, I should say. So I think the best thing that she can say, and she says it very forcefully, like there will be a repercussion if he doesn't take care of her. That's at least what I read into that. And for the first time, she stuck up for that girl.
I read it as, like, be a good man who doesn't treat women like shit.
Well, yeah. Well, that's a good way to look at it, too.
No, coming from the woman's perspective, I can see why she not necessarily was defending of the woman, but she was making sure that the man wasn't being horrible to a woman mm-hmm. because a man did wrong to her daughter.
Yeah, this... And the more we dissect this, it is harder to process because part of what's toughened up Mildred in this way is the ex-husband, you know? So, yeah, she's trying to understand her daughter and come to grips with that and get whatever the term might be. But she's also dealing with her own life where, you know, she wasn't raped and murdered, but... as close as they come, you could say.
Yeah, but she was also in a situation where the ex-husband, like, what, drew a blade on her?
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
So, she's been in a world where, like, men can essentially, like, actually dangerously hurt women. So, like, she just came from a protective standpoint. Like, don't treat women this way.
Right.
I feel for her.
It was an interesting scene, and again, I just say, for me, it was evidence that there was a change. I mean, up to that point, had she clocked him over the head with the bottle of wine, you wouldn't have been so surprised. To me, I was more surprised that she just put it down. Don't hurt her.
Well, I think the brilliance and the takeaway of this movie is that it's very tough, and you shouldn't pass judgment on things because you don't know how it's going to perspire. You know, it was very easy to paint Dixon in a portrait very early on. Not so easy by the end of the movie when you realize that shift. Same thing with Mildred. Because as soon as she was mean to Peter Dinklage's character, I was like, ooh, you're not so nice yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even Willoughby, like, I think as nice as what he did was, and the fact that he wrote everyone letters, I think that's quite unique. But the fact that, you know, he was sort of knowingly doing certain things, it's tough to say, like, was it right, was it wrong? And so, yeah, I think the interesting part is that you walk away with this movie not knowing what were the right choices and what were the wrong choices, right. And you start reassessing your own life of right. How can I pass judgment if there is no barometer?
Right. Yeah, and again, I go back to, like, the billboards were stating... What have you done? Like, why haven't you found this? So they make it a point. Like, there is this, it's an unsolved case. And they're trying to solve this case. And then this stranger comes into town. The scene in the gift shop, right?
Oh, and creeper.
Again, and this is the same guy that was in the bar, who's drunk at the bar, right? So there's this great, like, focus. And you're like, oh... Absolutely, this guy is the murderer. And when it comes out, it's like, yeah, we did a DNA test. Yeah, it's not him. And you're like, wait, how did he know so much about the case? And how did he know so much about Mildred, where she would be, and what to say? And why would anybody do that? Why would you do that to a person if you had no involvement whatsoever? Unless he was in one way, shape, or form involved, why would you talk about it to a friend and then
so cavalierly,
and then disgustingly, jokingly say, oh, wow, you know, she looked great, crispy, or something? And how does that person not be involved in one way, shape, or form? That, to me, was another thing that sort of kind of, they stacked up so much evidence. And then to say, yep, it's not our guy. Like, I had misplaced rage. No.
I think, you know, where I don't think it could have gone too far into this, but I think it's, I feel like both of you guys have read enough, like, thrillers and murder type mysteries to, you know, you sort of get pinned to a certain criteria and you're like, ooh, good. But there's a whole other list of criteria. And in fact, it's not to get too heady on this, but there is a notion that if you have the same amount of information, but if your confidence level shoots up, it can be worse because like your because of your confidence level, you get so blindsided by what actually is. And so in that case, we as an audience are so blindsided by the facts of like, boom, 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 boom. This has to be the guy. Doesn't necessarily have to.
No,
it's like the audience wants it to be the guy.
Absolutely.
Mildred wants it to be the guy.
Everyone wants it.
Yeah,
absolutely. But it was really set up that way. And hey, granted, I'm all up for a twist. And that was a twist. It wasn't him. And then what do we do? Because, see, again, this goes to the anger management or the rage, right? Dixon actually did something that was right, and he did it by procedure, getting the DNA by the book. He was a good cop, okay? And he told Mildred what he was going to do and why. And when you do the right thing in building up evidence and then you still, like, in a sense, you fell. He was told, it's not our guy. That rage that Mildred has, it's like, oh, my God. I finally got someone to my side. He did it by the book where he's not going to get thrown out. And still I don't have an answer to this. That, too, like, I understand the motivation for why that conversation, why these two ended up getting together. And I do think that by the end of the movie, there was an acceptance and, in a sense, a mutual respect. Her coming out to him and saying, I torched the police station. He's just like, of course you did. Yeah. I just felt that that line of dialogue together, there was an acceptance of them both. And there was not, when they went back to Ebbing, they wouldn't have that antagonistic rapport that they had at the beginning of the movie. And maybe Dixon is a better man too from his hospital visit. Maybe.
And also getting pummeled to almost death. Yeah, it kind of like lights a light bulb within
him. Yeah, I think that was self-punishment. Yeah, and getting beat to... Oof,
but also, it was, yeah. I don't want to say warranted, but yes, he needed it.
He
actually needed it for a character change of turning a new leaf, so
he needed
to speak.
A kick in the ass.
Exactly, literally.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that hospital scene was quite a good turning point because as soon as that kid finds out that it's him...
A grand coincidence, by the way, but yes.
It's a small town.
But nonetheless... He has every right to, first off, be a dick, but secondly, not do anything. He's still like, all right, I'm going to get you the water. You know, like, what purpose, what benefit is it for me to not help you, despite what you may have done to me?
Yeah, like, to still be angry at you.
Very well acted scene, by the way, too, that Caleb Landry Jones is Red in that scene. Because as soon as Rockwell gets put into that room, Rockwell obviously
knows what's up.
Mm-hmm.
Knows what's up, and he doesn't know who he is. But Rockwell tells him, which is, and again, I think a slight change of character.
It was also like a difference of a power shift too, because he, you know, when Dixon is literally immobile, he cannot move. This is the only time Red actually has the upper hand and could actually. Physically hurt
could have
him
done more
and
harm.
Dominate him. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it just shows that Dixon was actually finally put in his place.
Yep. And I think he learned through example of what was written in Willoughby's letter.
Yeah. And I think, and then the interesting part to me is when you look at Dixon as a character, he's looking really for a mentor, right? He's looking for the right path in life, and he thinks that. It comes from his mother, and he knows that the more path is through Willoughby, but he also has a wrong notion of who and how Willoughby acts, and isn't until, you know, he reads the letter and goes through literal footsteps or figurative footsteps, whatever you want to call them, that he gets this understanding.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And realizes, maybe I shouldn't listen to Mom, who's a chain smoking not so nice person.
Yeah, the mother. And it, but it also kind of explains why Dixon is the way he is. Like, when the mother is so against people in society, it makes sense that that would transfer to, like, that's the way he was raised, too. He doesn't care crap about people.
And he's still living at home.
Yeah, he can't escape it.
Yeah, he can't escape it. So, to your point, it seeps in. That's the, you know, if that's the way you're raised,
like
it's
see,
nature
like
versus nurture there. And that's nurture. That's the way you're raised. I'm not condoning it. But when the badness comes from the top, it can seep in. You brought up a good point because Dixon was always looking for acceptance in a sense. Yep. Even when his actions were bad.
The mother.
Right. Well, the mother. But there's also the desk sergeant. You know, there was, you know, he would always go to the, what did you think of that? Or, you know, and the desk sergeant, I mean, you know, he was just so ambivalent to, like, everything. He's like, so what do you think? I'm suspended? No, no.
You're fired.
You're fired. You're out. See you later.
Finally.
yeah, and so there were weird relationships taking place throughout the entire movie, and ultimately, that's why I believe this movie is more about character and the relationships than it is about the trying to figure out the hows and whats and whys of what happened.
Yeah, in this movie. Well, I think that's why it resonates for so many people. I think it's very of the times, and what's interesting is that it places it in a literal unknown place, a place that does not exist but could exist. And, you know, you could tie it into so many different things. You could tie it to the women's movement. You could tie it to, you know, the minority movement where they feel oppressed by cops and everything of that nature. And you could tie it to a political movement where people are just so frustrated with what's going on in the country that they feel like they have no literal voice of representation. And so, yeah, what do you have to kind of turn to? And the answer is it's not always pretty.
Right, yeah. And I think that's the sad but real thing about this film. It's so there's so many elements of this film that's so rooted in truth and in a lot of different aspects, like the ones that you just mentioned, that it's actually really not that far from reality. It's actually a very believable town with very believable people and their values and their belief system that when you watch this film, it's oddly very similar to reality.
Yeah, I mean, it's a microcosm of life that represents the larger portion of what's going on, mm-hmm. Albeit it's a small town. So you take that out of the city, the hustle and bustle of the city, and you're able to pace this movie in which you actually get to know people, because it is a languidly placed, you know, paced town itself. Everybody does know each other. In a sense, it's the type of Americana that, you know, we see in movies often. But there's this, and this is where it becomes Coen Brother-esque, is because, but there's a darkness that's running underneath this town of anger, of bigotry and racism, and how are we going to violence, and how are we going to deal and cope with all of this, particularly when our one main person takes himself out of the equation very early on. Where is your moral compass going to go? And by through his letters, by being a spirit or ghost and writing these letters, hoping that he can change people's moral compass so that they can go down a right direction.
Absolutely. All right, let's take a kind of quick step back and talk about the development, and then that'll spread into the other story elements we have yet to talk about. So as far as his inspiration for the billboards, he saw billboards like this in Florida. And so he kind of was like, oh, okay, well, you know, let me put something together because it's interesting. I've never seen something like this. And he created a fictional scenario around this, and everything sort of fell into place.
Yeah, and I believe that. And, like, you tend to see it with smaller towns. And, you know, like, and I come from a small town, so I know small billboards where people can actually get away with their personal opinions and actually voice their opinions on billboards to actually light fires under the people's asses to get something done. So I actually believe that, and not to say just like these states, but like southern and midwestern states tend to be way more conservative in some aspects, and like they'll voice their opinions in a very,
right,
I don't want to say small-minded way, but it, like, in a way that will like set off flags for people.
Right. And to McDonough, he himself, like, it's a crime film. That's not a crime film. It's almost like an anti-crime film. You know, he says he feels that this movie, Three Billboards, feels, and he did this on purpose, he wanted it to feel different from most crime films because there's the lingering question of what if there is no solution to this crime? In many crime films that we see, let's just say right now, 99% of them, because of this one movie, there's some semblance of a resolution. Whether the bad guy gets away and we know he's the bad guy and he got away with it or whatever, right? So the other way to look at this movie, and it's the way Frances McDormand looked at this movie too, is it is sort of kind of a Western. Even when you listen to the music, we listen to the opening themes. She, in a sense, you know, Willoughby is the sheriff of this town, right? And there are good guys, bad guys. We have our tropes of what our hero should be. And, you know, Mildred is an anti-hero. She's trying to figure out a crime. She's trying to figure out what happened. And when you look at it as a Western, a Midwest town, it's a one-horse town, so to speak, it's a very interesting notion, and I appreciate the way that she approached this too. And the music, I think, approaches it that way.
Well, she studied John Wayne in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Certainly an iconic Western man, for sure. And yeah, I think in other things that inspired it, Deer Hunter, you see elements of that, I think, for those of you who've seen the movie. If you haven't, I don't want to spoil. A good movie. Check it out.
It is a good movie.
So, yeah, it has all these elements. And Woody Harrelson, as little time overall as he is on the actual screen, he leaves, A, such an impact. But B, I just love his performance.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to say, like, at first, you kind of wonder, like, is he undermining Mildred? Does he have a huge case of the I don't cares? And that completely shifts as time goes by. And it goes to show first impression shouldn't drive your overall impression of a character. Certainly not in this movie.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think Woody Harrelson's great. I liked his character because at the beginning you want the audiences like led to believe that it was just pure negligence on his part. But you do find out that he did everything that he could and just really stopped pursuing it because he essentially hit an impasse. But also, like, the way he treated his wife and stuff, like, you knew on some level he was a good guy. And, like, you felt for him. But also, as terrible as his suicide was, it did actually light the fire for other people to actually be like, oh, hey. It gave people motivation to actually look into this case and actually start taking the initiative and do something about it.
Right. And Willoughby is an interesting character, and even as our writer and director here, Martin McDonough, says of Willoughby, basically he's like, you know, he's a character, he's a decent man who tends to see the best in people, which through the letters we see that. He goes, and he wrote him as an archetypal good smart town cop, but we discover early on he's not in the best of health, and now he's facing up to some dark choices and dark realities. Mildred goes against him, and again too, at the beginning of the movie, you understand Mildred's rage. She feels that the cops aren't doing their job, and you can understand that. And so at the beginning, she's doing what she's doing for all the, we believe, right reasons. But yet Willoughby has his own good reasons to act the way he's acting. So that puts these two characters not necessarily at odds, but we now, once we learn of the of that cancer and everything, we see the motivation. And you're right. I think that this was a great performance by Woody Harrelson. Only seconded it to, like, his performance in Edge of 17. I thought was brilliant. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Yes, that was a good one.
And what he's shown throughout the years is he's a good actor. You know, he can play good. He can play bad. You know, he's definitely shed, you know, his Woody persona from Cheers, albeit I know that's what gave him his rise to fame. Comedy. And again, when you watch Cheers, he is brilliant in that role, right? So, but you would never think if you were just watching Cheers that maybe Woody Harrelson would amount to much. But within the past couple of years, you've seen him in a lot of things where he's played different characters. He's been, and he's great to, he's great to watch. It's great to watch. And he was particularly good in this movie.
Absolutely. Let's focus on Mildred in particular, and Frances McDormand, obviously, because she's getting a lot of notoriety, and she's the one who kicks this movie off. Whether or not she's the main character, we sort of debated, but I think one of the interesting parts is she didn't feel the role, even though the role was written for her, she felt it really wasn't for her, that it required someone younger, which is interesting to think, but I can't even posit who would play this role. You know, I think she's perfect.
Yeah, I think she's great. And I think she does an amazing job of, like, coming across as a strong, authoritative woman who can actually get a message across, couldn't intimidate you at all the right moments. And, like, if you saw her, you might actually be afraid and want to leave the room. So, like, she commands such a presence that draws people's attention, and you actually have to listen to her, because if she's saying something, good chances you should pay attention. And it's, like, and there's only a few actors that can, like, actually do that, and she does such a great job. And something about Mildred is that you kind of just love the woman who just says things just as it is, because I feel like women tend to be I don't want to say, like, brought down a bit, but they're more, like, reserved when they speak. But, like, Mildred gave no fucks. And no. It was actually fun to watch. It's fun to watch when a woman just, like, says it as it is and calls people out on their
sure.
shit.
And Martin McDonagh had said that he really had Frances McDormand in mind for writing Mildred. And to him, he felt, you know, there weren't any other actresses, he thought, that had all the elements that Mildred needed. And obviously, I think many of the actors chosen, there were many elements to every performance, but particularly Mildred. She had to be in touch with a kind of working class sensibility, as well as a rural sensibility. And she had to be someone who wouldn't sentimentalize the character. She never once sentimentalized that character at all. In all of Frances's work, and I agree, it's fundamentally truthful, even when you watch a movie like Fargo. Now, there is a funny story, too, about this. McDormand apparently ran into McDonagh about 15 years prior. She had just watched his play The Pillow Man. And after briefly talking about his new film career, she suggested he write a film role for her. And McDormand goes on to say, as soon as I said the words right out of my mouth, she goes, I wish I could have taken him back, because you're not supposed to do that. But then 15 years later, he sent me the script and I read it, loved it. And I just think that it's funny from a relationship that started 15 years ago. Now, why among comrades, you know, colleagues, friends, comrades, you can't say, geez, I wish you should write a script for me. Why not? But maybe this, I don't know.
Well, I think that maybe I get it. You don't want to come off as pushy. Right. Maybe something better for those of you out there. Hey, we should collaborate. Yeah. Maybe that's a more appropriate version of that. But hey, you know, whatever.
And it took 15 years, but you know, again, I can't think. You know, maybe Annette Bening.
Maybe Sigourney Weaver could be great.
Because she could be tough as nails, too. Sigourney exactly. Weaver would have been, yeah.
I was like, there's really, if you think about it, there's a few women that could come to mind, but I think Francis just does a great job, like, with that presence of an authoritative calling out. And these, he's just calling out police guys, you know, like actual people in the law enforcement.
And for 2 minutes, she has to seem vulnerable. Again, the scene in the gift shop where that stranger walks into town, right?
You're worried for her life.
She was too. Exactly. I actually got the sense that for the first time, she was actually scared. And she was not going to exactly know what to do. And then a few scenes later, you know, she kicks two kids in the private parts for throwing a can at her car. That scene was very, very funny, by the way. I thought it was like, she threw the can in my car? What can? Boom! Did you throw the can? I didn't. Boom. And I was like, oh my God.
But
and
like she hits another girl.
A girl.
All right.
Hey, listen.
She is also like the same age as your daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I appreciate just the nonchalant scene. Of like, okay, if your parents aren't going to raise you right and you're going to be a little prick about it, yeah. I don't care who you are.
That was a funny scene.
No, that's good.
Yeah, she gets in the car and drives away. Thanks, Ma.
I was like, good. Millennials do need a kick in the ass.
Right. What did you guys think about the son speaking? A witch, and since we're kind of on that, because you know, yeah, there's a side to him. He's just embarrassed because you know he of course is going to be ridiculed at school. What's interesting, I feel like there's a side to him that really believes what his mom's doing is somewhat noble, but perhaps some of the ways in which she's going about it are just complete head scratchers to him, and he's like, okay, like stop.
Right. I think Lucas Hedges is great. We talked well about him in Manchester by the Sea and Lady Bird.
Right.
So I think he's a really good actor. And I think it just shows, like, you feel bad for this guy because he raised by these two people. These two crazy people in their own sense. So, like, you just feel bad because that's the life that he was brought up in. But you do feel bad as a sibling who also lost his daughter. So on some level, like, he's dealing with loss, but also dealing with the anger of his parents. He's just stuck in a rock and a hard place, unfortunately.
Yeah, he is. He's in like an unenviable position, and he wants to love his mother.
Well, he's also the only one that knows the truth of what happened before. He was present when she said, "I hope you get raped."
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he has that to contend with.
Right.
Yeah, and then he was also fighting against his father, too, who beats up his mother right in front of him. So that's the life that he has to live with, and it's actually sad. You just feel bad because he's in a terrible situation.
Oh, awful. And there's nothing... It's one thing to have a smothering mother, okay? She's not a smothering mother. She's almost the exact opposite, and she's so, like, in your face. I mean, she kicked two of his classmates, a male and a female, in their private parts, gets in the car, and just leaves them there. And he knows he's going to be like, oh, God, Mom. Like,
why?
Yeah, I was like, why? She embarrasses him for different reasons, not because she, like, smothers him and kisses in front of everybody. But it's like, your mom's weird. Your mom's really mean. And he's got to live with that. And at the same time, he loves his mom. He knows, you know, it was his sister that was murdered. And Lucas Hedges plays it really well. Again, the scene at the fire. Again, tough scene to watch. But everybody, he was... I like the son. You felt bad for the son.
It felt like he was waiting for a moment to have a meaningful dialogue with her, and it just never came. Because he wanted that was part of that fire scene. Like, he did what was needed. He brought those things to her, but he was trying to say like let it go, and she was like no. And you knew, like, he was trying to pick his spot of when to get in and just say, like, okay, like, enough's enough.
Right.
She wasn't having any of it, and he just let it go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was no... That opportunity was not going to present itself.
Yeah.
Unless he really wanted to be as bullheaded as her and just say, mm-hmm. All right, we're talking.
And you're right. He was looking for that. It's a good observation. He was looking for that meaningful conversation, that next step. That was never coming for him because her focus was so much on this that he most likely, the way I read it, was there was a neglect that he was feeling for her being an actual
Yeah, and mom. I think his problem was he was just an innocent bystander in all of this.
Oh.
Like, yeah, and well, he has no control over it.
No.
It's a line, I forget from what movie, but it, you know, it applies to so many different things. Like, you're not the only one grieving. And I right. could very well hear him saying that if they actually had a conversation. It's like, and the part about Mildred that I don't like is she has that very narcissistic side to her. And yeah, very much I want to slap her and say, you're not the only one grieving.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. so it's as Sam Rockwell said, it's supposed to be deliberately messy and a difficult film. So, yes.
It's all of that.
I agree.
There's no easy way around it.
No.
On a more lighter note, Sam Rockwell wore padding to make his character appear chubbier.
Dude.
That I can say with full confidence. So there you go. Should we get more into the production side of things, unless there's something that's absolutely that you're dying to talk about from the story perspective?
You know, again, through the certain perspective of Dixon, and again, you know, Dixon seems to be everything you would despise in any person, whether it be male and or female.
Right.
You don't like those qualities at all. And I think where the writing and the performance really, too, you know, there is something in him. And again, I can only liken him to Archie Bunker because of his misplaced ignorance about people and things. You can tell that there is some semblance of a warmth. You could tell that he could be a good cop if he applied himself. Mm-hmm. He could have been the chief of police or the new sheriff in town had he just channeled emotions differently and applied himself to doing it, because it shows that. And I think that's a very... We talk about how can you like a bad guy? Well, this is a guy where you could have sort of ambiguous... Like you don't hate him by the end of the movie. You're like... I don't know. To me, I always find those characters to be very fascinating to watch. I'm not saying he's the protagonist. I don't condone the actions.
Well, let's talk about it, because Martin is... He is upset by the backlash over him being a racist, but he said, you know, I'm not making movies for six-year-olds. So, yeah, it's going to be a little bit polarizing. What do you guys feel about that side of it, where people are saying, oh, what they're saying? And so... But to me, my stance on it is that, okay, if you feel like there isn't racism in America and that we shouldn't portray it in a certain character in a film that is very much an adult and is trying to talk about certain messages or at least create a dialogue, then what world do you live in? And I want to move there.
And to take that a step, what this movie does too is, because we have Willoughby, who has seen Dixon's actions, and in fact, he's also been called on the floor to it, too. What do you keep this guy around for? He's mm-hmm. like, you know, you don't see him every day like I do. There's a good side of him trying to get out. I'm trying to give him that opportunity. And he's the only person that was on his side, in all honesty, in that town.
Except for Mother. But she hated him, too. Right. She was bruised. She was like, you piece of crap.
You're right. So... That to me is very interesting, that somebody saw there could be a goodness in him and kept him on a police force where you're really not supposed to have any racism on a police force. And he kept him around because he did see something in him and he wanted to try to encourage that. There aren't that many movies that will take that attitude towards someone who's a full-on bigot and racist. And this movie does tackle it. And that letter being the last letter.
Well, it's the idea that you can change somebody and that you can positively affect someone's life no matter what, you know, their level of hatred, let's say. Which I think is, I if you really stop and think about it, that's actually a positive message.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so what? Just because someone's not the way you foresee them or want them to be, that you should quit on them? Like, That's not good.
Right.
And that just builds more resentment mm-hmm. and evil because of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, I liked the fact that like he saw like something within Dixon that the audience didn't see immediately because it was so masked by his verbal comments and actions, and which is really sad when that speaks louder than, you know, what is actually there. But it does show that like Dixon on some level had a redeeming quality because he could have just sat on his ass and with his mother watching TV, drinking beers, instead of actually taking the initiative to get the DNA, talking to this guy, maybe questioning him to see if he had any involvement. Like, he didn't have to do that, but he did.
Yeah, he didn't. It was a time in which he actually felt useful to somebody. Mm-hmm. And I felt the letter was what pushed him to go through that. It inspired him. If that letter never came, he was never going to change.
Well, yeah, it was also like just what also was happening when he was reading the letter. He was literally getting blown up
right.
by Mildred because she was blowing up the place.
That's a great
so
scene.
So it's just there's like a lot of different factors that actually physically and mentally forced him to change.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Speaking of which, it should be noted that Mildred, I appreciate the fact that she had, for as little support as she thought she actually had more than she did bargain for.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. She got Willoughby. She never expected Willoughby to be on her side, but Peter Dinklage, you know, just the random people. What's his name? The guy who sets up the billboards. Red.
Oh, yeah.
Red. Good old I mean, Red. There were nice people in this town. They weren't all shitheels. I mean,
yeah, no,
James is Peter Dinklage. Is actually a nice guy.
Well, yeah, right,
I feel bad for him too. But yes. Also the secondary guy who actually physically put up the billboards, and he came yes. back and was like,
right.
I have a second print if you want me to put that up for right. you. So like she, like you said, she had friends in places she didn't know.
And she had the friend who ran the gift shop too.
Yeah.
The press was not her friend.
No.
No. I love how she called out that reporter. Like, yeah. Live on,
put that on
air.
The 5 p.m.
Oh, it was so good. Because that's also in the trailer. And when I watched the trailer, I was like, yeah, I would totally see this. It's going to be good.
All right. So let's shift gears. I think the story of them filming this is quite fascinating. They went to North Carolina. Lasted about a month, just a little bit over. But they shot in these various locations, and they let the public sort of be part of it, whether as extras or just observe.
Right.
And in fact, Woody Harrelson was so nice that he just signed autographs on his, you know, off time.
Right.
That's awesome because, you know, I love when stories like that, because when films go to smaller town locations, yeah, the small towns are usually going to eat them up because they have nothing else going for them. That, right. I mean, that sounds terrible, but I come from a small town, so I know. Because here in LA, when you see productions, you're like, oh, crap, I have to take another route to work. Whereas where it's so more like...
It's an event.
Yeah, it's right. like it's not as common for the small town people. They're like they're generally more welcoming, and like wants to get involved. And usually for small town productions, they let the actual people from the town be in the movie as yeah. extras and like serve their purpose.
And the townspeople actually made like their yeah. tchotchkes, you know, ebbing, and they had a good time there. But again. The way I think about it is too is that sometimes a film production can come into a town and just take over, right? And people aren't happy when you just take over, but when you're in a small town and you allow the townspeople to be part of what's going on, there's always a fascination as to how movies are made, and when you don't,
it's what keeps us in business.
Well, right, absolutely, and. You know, and when that doesn't happen in your town often, it's not like Los Angeles, right? There's a big, oh, my God. Oh, and Woody Harrelson definitely has a name for himself, right? And when the people are nice, they sign autographs. Hey, we're going to put you, you're going to be an extra. Like, that's welcoming. I think it's good for the business.
Well, I think it goes a step further, right? Both your sentiments work, and that's nice enough. you know, the police station itself was not a police station. It was a place that they rented. It was a furniture store that they graciously allowed them to make over, essentially, into a police station, which is, you know, that's awfully nice. You don't have to do that.
Right.
So certainly it goes to that level of extent, and it works quite nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just cinematography-wise, I mean, it's just a gorgeous movie in general.
That's why I thought there was a real ebbing until I realized. You know, I have a friend who's from Missouri, and I almost made the faux pas of going, hey, have you ever been to this ebbing? Glad I researched it first, because it seemed like...
Maybe you could tell them it was a joke. You were joking.
Yeah, I never asked it.
It definitely seemed like a Midwestern town. And it was like, you got the back country roads. And like, I think there's a line in the movie where like, oh, you took this exit out or into town. Because that's such a small town. There's always different ways to get in and out of your small town. And you got the scope of the actual land. Like, you can see downtown from your backyard or wherever it is. It definitely felt like a small town vibe.
Right. But a believable small town vibe. Mm-hmm. Like when that film crew packs up and leaves, so long, folks, life goes back to normal in that small town. And the conversation goes, wow, we were just in a movie. But life just goes on for them. And I felt there wasn't like so much disruption that there was in such goodwill that they just left that town on such a positive note. That, yeah, it's still that small town, but now they have a little bit of something special. Hey, their town's going to the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
So.
There you go. As far as editing, it was interesting. You know, we talk about editing a lot, and as far as this goes, Martin made sure his editor was available far in advance. He was like, hey, you're going to be free to do this. And... he was, luckily, and they as they were shooting, when we hear these stories a lot, as they're shooting, they're putting this thing together, which is great, because then you can start to get a feel for a movie like this. And other people have attributed, like I think Frances McDormand, she attributed that he was very calm as director, because he knew what he wanted. And then, so, as you're sort of seeing this assembly start to come together, it only reaffirms, okay, great, we've got something cool here.
Yeah, and they were very choice with the editing, too, and the placement of certain scenes for the character building, because they're, you know, the flashback with Mildred and her daughter, that was actually placed later in the film, and they made the conscious effort to and decision to actually move it closer in earlier in the film, because you wanted to establish that Mildred does feel bad, because... Mm-hmm. Throughout the entire film, if the flashback was later in the film, you wouldn't feel for this character anymore. But since they put it earlier, the audience is already feeling for her. And also just for the building of Dixon's redemption arc, too, they had to, like really make his character somewhat, like, build up to a redemption compared to just making him bigot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and being in the firehouse and the way that was filmed as well. You know, we talk about, too, there is the relationship between the director and his crew with Frances McDormand. They were antagonistic, and I'm putting quotes around that, on set, so that, like, she would, like, he would say, suggest notes, and she would, nah, I don't believe that I should do that. But they found it to be helpful only for her performance. And the director didn't take anything by it. She was in her character. And I think that's really cool. That's really fun. Like, they were almost in a sense purposely harassing one another. But out of, let's push this. Let's get this. I know you don't hate me, but we're doing this for the art.
They pushed their buttons in the right way. Harassing, maybe not the term.
Yeah, exactly.
But absolutely, and that's great. You know, I think that you ultimately want that, right? If you're playing a sport, you want a coach that pushes you in the right ways, because you'll get better. Or, you know, that's why rivalries in athletic competitions are amazing, because it's that person that takes you to the next level because you want to beat him. And so in this sense, it's great. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to work with people that elevate, not lower.
Yeah. And do it in a way, like we talked about, you do it in a way that's respectful.
Yeah.
It's respectful like, harassment.
It's creatively challenging you
yes.
to be better.
Excuse me. Absolutely. All right. Score-wise, the challenging part for me, it has been a while since I've last seen this movie. And I remember the score being something that stood out in a good way. It really fit the movie. But I can't remember the specifics of the mechanics of how they were able to pull it off.
Right. I think the moment where I definitely remember the score was when the billboards were on fire.
Yes.
Because it was like it literally built to such a climactic moment that everything was up in flames and you just feel for her. And the music built to a crescendo that like it just evoked so much emotion because she's just in a state of panic. She's not really saying anything. She's just desperately trying to put these fires out, and the music definitely like reflects that.
It reflects it too. And Carter Burwell, who did the composing on this, it's interesting since we are talking about Mildred and the fire. For him, what he felt the most important thing for the music to do was to keep the audience in Mildred's heart and on her side, which with that character, it can be very tough to do. And this is a great shining example of how music, when not overbearing and done with purposeful meaning, can help lend empathy, sympathy mm-hmm. for a character that could be harsh or rough around the edges, so to speak. And, you know, he said, so there are three basic themes in the score: Mildred's heart, Mildred at war, and death, which is the theme that surrounds not only Mildred's loss, but of Woody Harrelson's character. And all three themes are in that movie, so.
That they are. Where I thought a scene that encompasses all the right elements, mm-hmm. acting, cinematography, sound design, and score, and you could even say writing, editing, and all that, was when Dixon does throw out Red. Because we just track that thing and we're just following this, and it's got such active movement in all aspects. It just flows so well. It's a tough scene to watch, but as far as technical components, I don't think it gets better than that.
No,
it's great watching the camera literally following Dixon from the police, going across the street, up the stairs, and like beating the crap out of him to the point of throwing him out. That's like all one take.
Yeah, and it was done to such an effect that it doesn't pop out of the movie where you go, oh, they're just trying to be flashy, right? Mm-hmm. It was meant to capture the brutality of the moment. And you don't realize exactly that technique that has been done in a lot of movies like Birdman, all one take, and all this stuff. So it wasn't in this movie. It sort of takes you a couple of minutes to go, oh, wow, they haven't cut. And then when you start to dissect that scene, you know, there is a reason why he comes up and he breaks the glass. Well, because he's got to get through. Camera's going to follow him upstairs. But if you notice, too, one of the things that was great about that scene, Dixon's clomping up those stairs. The camera goes down because he takes the gun out. And we are following the gun. And then he puts the gun back in and takes out, like, his baton, right? And what's fascinating is he throws the kid out the window. And at that point, you're going, holy shit, he just threw him out a window. Like, okay, where's the stunt person that's actually going to fall to the ground or what did it do? And then, I mean, so that's brutal. And then the secretary gets punched in the face and she goes down like a sack of potatoes. And you're like, what? And he just walks down. He picks Red up again. And then he just walks back into the office. And I'm like going, and the whole town saw it. It's not like it was in broad daylight. And then I'm like going,
you're washing it.
Yeah, I'm like going, huh. And he didn't get fired for that.
Yep.
I go, wow, okay. It's just Dixon being Dixon, I guess.
Dixon being a dick.
but a powerful scene, and one that I didn't like. Oh, look at they were being tricky.
Yeah, no, nothing tricky about that. And I think had they cut away from that, it wouldn't have been as impactful. Because oftentimes on movement like that, you cut A, because you don't have the coverage, or B, you're trying to speed it up. I'm glad they didn't have to do both.
Yeah, I'm with you
at all.
Yeah, and to watch it in real time is just, you're like, oh my god, this guy is capable of anything.
Right.
In a matter of minutes.
And it all started from him just looking out the window up to that office. And then he just gets up and you're like, what's going on? And then when
there's
he breaks
that
the
curiosity window, factor of like, yeah, what are you going to do?
What's he doing? And then he smashes the window outside of just opening up the door. Like, there was nothing subtle about that scene.
So that is a great moment in cinema history. Not for mankind, but for cinema, indeed.
And it's played very well by all the actors. Again, as a moviegoer who watches a lot of movies, you figure, okay, he bounces off the roof. They probably have, like, padding up there that he's falling on that we don't see. But somebody is falling now? Or because it really seemed like somebody fell onto the ground from that. It's like, okay, where's the stunt person? Poor Red.
Poor Red, indeed. All right, so let's talk numbers, shall we? It's always interesting to talk about these movies because they start off with limited release. So talking about, like, opening weekend is a non-starter there. However, worldwide thus far, quite a good chunk of change. As I checked a couple of days ago, so over 100 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Great.
Yeah, that's you know, again, 46 million domestic, 57 million foreign. So, which makes me wonder, okay, what do the foreign territories latch on to have a higher gross on this small kind of a movie, right? When it's when you look at a movie like The Mummy, which its foreign box office far out eclipsed the American box office, you know why. It's Tom Cruise, right? There are certain movies like that that'll do far better overseas because of talent involved. I'm wondering, what's the talent involved? Like, Francis McDormand's huge overseas, or is it Sam Rockwell, or was it the storytelling? I'm trying to figure out what sparked.
I think it's the story.
Yeah.
You know? Think?
I think it's as simple as that. No offense to any of the actors. I think it's just a good story.
Yeah.
Because it's human nature type of story.
Yeah.
So, which is relatable to anyone, no matter what country you're in.
Yeah, and we talked about Darkest Hours a few weeks ago, and that too is a worldwide $100 million.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, those movies do good foreign internationally because geographical location in the movie is also foreign to us,
right? And you know, 46 mil domestically again for a movie whose budget was estimated at 12 million. Fox Searchlight has done quite well.
Yeah, that's a big return just domestically.
Domestically, it's a huge return. So you know, kudos. You know, they marketed it well. It got this Golden Globe and Academy Award press, which they were taking advantage of. And, yeah, I mean, 46 million is nothing to sneeze at for a movie. And you got to think of it, too. 12 million, there's the P&A, and then there's the Academy campaign. So that's going to inflate, you know, your P&A. Your publicity and advertiser, your prints and advertising. So, you know, maybe all in it was 40 million that they're putting into this. But when you're looking at 46 and it's going to go up, and then when you look at 57 from foreign territories, yeah, they're going to do pretty well. Yeah, those are really good numbers.
Absolutely. And 93 on Rotten Tomatoes, I think, deserved. Unlike we just talked, for those of you curious, we talked Phantom Thread. We felt that was undeserving. Mm-hmm. That's our. I thought it worked really well. They summarize as three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri, deftly balances black comedy against searing drama and draws unforgettable performances from its veteran cast along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Sam Rockwell has already won an award for this role as well, so I mean, he's in good contention for Academy Award for Best Supporting.
And Frances, she's the front runner.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I want to, I said this was Coen brother-esque. Months ago, we talked about this movie called Suburbicon, which was written by the Coen brothers, right? Okay. I remember you liking it most, but you liked it more than we did.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. I mean, I'm not saying you loved it. I'm not saying you're even recommending it, but I'm saying when I look at that movie wanted to be
this movie.
Three Billboards. And Three Billboards nails that Fargo-esque feel because we actually get to know the characters and their quirks. You have, you know, these are quirky characters that are, they're not so far out of touch that they're unrelatable. You can understand.
Well, there's an honesty to them, and that's true. Suburbicon lacked an honesty, I would say. Anyway, so, check that movie out. Check out our anatomy if you care or don't. I'll live either way.
Mm-hmm.
A- on cinema score, so definitely good word of buzz and so forth. Moving it forward, definitely a lot to look forward to. And as we sort of wrap this up, I'm most curious. I really, if out of all the Oscar movies that I wanted to continue a dialogue with, I this would be the movie. Simply because it just has so many gray areas,
mm-hmm.
and it's a push and pull type of movie that that I really want to know where people stand on.
You know, and I want to talk marketing for a bit too, sure. Because okay, so when I first read a description of this movie, I'll be honest, I was like, nope, because the description said a mother mourning the loss of a daughter, and I'm like, nope, that, I don't need to see anybody mourning losses. I just it's hard for me to see. Then I started to hear how good this movie was. Then you see the trailer, and then I was like, okay, well maybe this movie goes down a different path, right? And then I saw the movie. I was like, oh, it went down a different path, okay? But not quite the happy-go-lucky path, but maybe because they were trying to make it feel, at least from the trailers and the television advertising, that it had that quirkiness that a Fargo had. But man, you know, Frances McDormand's performance, like I said, for me, it ended up being a difficult movie to watch. But I understand the love that's being thrown to this movie because it is different. It's told differently than other movies that we've seen this year. And that is a breath of fresh air.
Absolutely.
When we see something that's an attempt at being original.
Absolutely.
That works.
Mm-hmm. Gotta applaud it. All right. Well, thank you guys, as always, for joining us. We do appreciate you spending time with us. It means the world to us. We have fun doing it, so hopefully you have fun, you know, with us.
Right.
Anyway, as I made mention, do comment below. Let us know. Spread the word that we are out here doing this. We are completing our Oscar run of movies, talking about them. We'll try to do some sort of Oscar-type prediction stuff sometimes.
Sure.
A lot of you guys have fun with that. Nonetheless, in the meantime, you can interact with us more directly with Marissa. Her social media is at Serafini TV.
That's right.
And at DMovies 1701 for the Dimitri Panos, the one and only.
Thank God. There's only one. Many people would attest.
And I'm at Phil Svitek, and of course, this is the Popcorn Talk Network. Anthony, who is our gracious engineer for this series. Anthony, you want to give a plug to your show on the network? We don't have to stop the music. You just give a little plug.
Anthony's not here today. It's Juliet on the mic.
Hi!
Yeah.
You guys did a bait and switch.
No, I knew it.
Did. I do the Versace show on AfterBuzz TV, which is really, really neat. You guys should check that out. And yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, Anthony does the horror movie news. That's it. So definitely check that out on Popcorn Talk. And yes, check out Versace on AfterBuzz TV. In the meantime, thank you guys as always. We truly, truly appreciate you. We'll see you next week for more movies. And of course, if you're bored and can't fill your week, go through the library of shows that we've done.
Yeah, go pick up. I mean, yeah, there's so many Blu-rays out.
Hundreds of movies.
Like Dunkirk is out right now. And if you have it on Blu-ray, if you haven't seen it and you see it on demand, then you can come check us out. We're immortalized on the Ethernets.
That's right.
In the cloud. My head's all always right. in the clouds.
Thank you guys as always.
Bye. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.